Welcome to the Mothball Prophecies. I am your host, Jonathan. Accept no cheap imitations. That's right, folks. We're back. I've been reorganizing and restructuring things over here, so I apologize for the delay in getting episodes out. There are some big changes on the horizon, which I'll get to at the end of the episode, but I think they'll benefit everyone involved, especially you, the listeners. But until then, let's get back to where we left off with the Ursuline Nuns of New Orleans. For those who might have forgotten what happened up to this point, because, admittedly, it's been over a month, here's a short recap. The Ursuline Nuns, in a bid to retain agency in a Catholic-run Europe, decided to form a closed order that would teach reading and writing to the nobles of France. Once the French had control of Louisiana, they sent the quote-unquote casket girls to New Orleans in order to reverse the declining French population. The casket girls, who may or may not have been vampires, depending on what the listener wants to believe, did actually reduce the mortality rate, and a year later, the Ursuline Nuns set sail for the Crescent City to establish their order and have more success teaching reading and writing than their previous expedition in Alabama, which set a very low bar. But as we'll find out, on many levels, New Orleans in the 1700s and 1800s had more monstrous things in store than vampires. Before we continue, you, the listener, should know that this half of our mini-series on the Ursuline Nuns is going to involve some heavy topics. If you'd rather deal with the mystical and paranormal side of things, turn around now and listen to our other episodes. Just know that I will be getting into some challenged and problematic territory with history, sexism, and religion as it pertains to the foundation on which current-day New Orleans exists. So, settle in and get ready for a history lesson after these messages.
Dr. Pinkerton of the Consortium of Genius here, ensconced within my secret lab. At long last, the time has come to reveal my master plan. While you have all been preoccupied with that insipid but popular virus making the rounds, I have been readying my laboratory for a bold new test. The evaluation and elimination of my sonic competition for World Takeover! Yes, ladies and gentlemen, every week, I shall be capturing a different band here in the secret lab and subjecting them to hideous, hard-rocking experimentation live! Friday night at 8 p.m. Be here to see what fate befalls the unwary and find out if they can escape from the secret lab!
That's Escape from the Secret Lab, every Friday night at 8 p.m. Central. Check out escapefromthesecretlab.com to see which bands are playing and watch for a chance to win prizes and enjoy the mayhem. Now, back to the story. When the Ursuline Nuns arrived in Louisiana in 1727, they encountered a place that was wholly unlike France. Apart from the tropical climate, Louisiana, and the area that would become modern-day New Orleans in particular, was full of fluctuating poverty and illness. Oh, how the times have changed. The population was far from homogeneous, comprising French, German, Creole, Native American, and African people. The Ursulines quickly set up shop and got to work, providing local women with the skills to read and write while simultaneously indoctrinating them with the rites and rituals of the Catholic Church. This was not restricted to just white women in New Orleans. The classes would have been exceedingly small if that had been the case. The Ursulines taught everyone, regardless of race. This really did not bother anyone in New Orleans, many of whom were already in, to use an antiquated term, mixed marriages before the Ursulines even arrived. This is where we find further proof that the Ursulines and the casket girls mentioned in the previous episode never crossed paths. You see, a religious order founded on the mission of education and literacy had a penchant for keeping extensive records. Nothing exists regarding the Casket Girls working with the Ursuline nuns or taking up residence in the attic of the convent. I'm sure someone will point out that if they can keep records, then they can also omit the truth. But I'm not here to persuade or provoke. Within a year, the Ursulines took on boarders ranging from the upper and middle classes to enslaved Native American and African girls, ensuring that they were inadvertently more literate and educated than the men in their lives, and that they were getting more people to sign up for Catholic-flavored mysticism in the process. As the years progressed and New Orleans grew, the nuns found themselves walking two paths. The first was that of humble piety, where the nuns would take in anyone who wished to learn and serve God. The second fell more in line with their role in France. The nuns would educate the elite and influence the social and economic navigation of the city as it moved closer to the 19th century. This duality would become dangerous later on, but I'm getting ahead of myself. In addition to literacy, the Ursuline nuns also expanded their purview to include offering aid to women who were abused by their husbands. They cared for the sick, sheltered the orphaned, protected the abused, and built their wealth through enough to offer a financial net to families that experienced poverty or the loss of the head of the household. Some of the nuns went to such extreme piety, embracing the concept of not living in excess of the least of us, that they would labor and eat just like the slaves of New Orleans. However, it should be noted, through the lens of the 21st century, of course, that for as much agency as the nuns had, and with all their revolutionary ideas on education and freedom for women in general, not one did anything to end the concept of slavery in Louisiana, even though it went against the word of their God. By 1732, over 32% of the women in New Orleans were literate, which was gaining on the 47% of literate men in the city. As of 1762, the literate women in New Orleans outnumbered literate men, 72%. To 70%. 82% of Creole wives were literate, and 11% of married households comprised a literate wife with an illiterate husband. Free women of color were gaining in literacy as well. Many of the women throughout New Orleans managed households and business finances, made investments, and basically gave a huge middle finger to the men of the city, who somehow thought that being born with a penis was a virtue that was supposed to entitle them to something. Meanwhile, the women who learned to read and write found that they could get much further ahead in the world. But 1763 had big things in store for both France and, by extension, Louisiana and New Orleans. This was the end of the Seven Years' War, and Louis XV transferred ownership of Louisiana to his cousin, Charles III of Spain. This did not go over well for the people of New Orleans, and when Spain first tried to take the reins, the Spanish governor was forced out by a rebellion of French planters. They did not want to be further in debt by Spain's new taxes and rigid economic policies. However, Alexander O'Reilly, an Irishman who happened to be a general in Spain's military, marched into New Orleans in 1769 and established the Cabildo. While the Spanish population would never outnumber the French and Creole populations, Spain introduced their own take on social order, which include their own flavor of slavery and racism. Remember how toward the start of the episode I warned you that we were going to get into some heavy subjects? We have arrived. When I was researching this, I forgot momentarily that racism wasn't and isn't an abstract concept. After all, if the Ursuline nuns could take an abstract concept such as faith with Mary as the conduit between God and the masses, why couldn't the whole of Europe take an abstract concept such as racism and turn it into a very real economic practice? One which may actually still exist. But back to the story. Even among Europeans, racism had varying degrees of severity. The Spanish believed in purity of the blood and brought that to New Orleans. So the Ursuline nuns, who for decades brought enslaved and free women of color into their folds, found themselves in a very difficult position when the Spanish came to town with their own weird version of racism, where the lightness of one's skin determined, in their eyes, one's worth as a human being. By all accounts, while slavery was very much a thing, the French and Creoles in New Orleans seemed to be rather indifferent, or at least less rabid about skin color as the measure of a person than the Spanish. So, as to preserve their order and continue their mission, the Ursuline nuns pivoted slightly. They still accepted women and children of color into the convent and continued to teach them, but they were now segregated from the white and or lighter-skinned girls and women. And outside of the convent, the Spanish rulers appealed to the planters by bringing more rigid and social control over non-whites. In 1797, the fishbowl experiment in the Crescent City became even more complex, as Spain opened up the port of New Orleans to trade with America. This saw an influx of people from New York, Philadelphia, and other cities, as well as an increase in African slaves, which dovetailed with Spain's ambitions. The Ursulines, however, maintained their vision of providing equal care and equal affection without exception. The Ursuline nuns, either consciously or because their existence had the approval of the largest Christian organization in the world at the time, kept to their mission of education and literacy, which promoted the integration of people regardless of sex, race, or social status. Remember, the Ursuline nuns were not some weird Christian sect. They were a Catholic institution, now firmly rooted in North America. And yes, there were Ursuline convents elsewhere. Alabama, as we've mentioned before. Boston, as well. And I believe Ohio? They certainly have a presence in Ohio now, but I'm still iffy on whether they were actually there as of the 1790s. With the opening of trade in New Orleans, sugarcane production increased. So in finding the absolute worst way to handle the rising demand, slavery also increased. And after years of walking the path between God and the masses, the Ursuline nuns, seeing a lucrative opportunity, also fell in with the prevailing attitudes and owned not just sugarcane fields, but also slaves. Their sugarcane ventures, however, did not go as well as they thought, and certainly not as well as their real estate ventures, for a good portion of the revenue generated for the convent came not just from teaching the wealthy, but from properties held in New Orleans. Now, there are no records, for you'll remember the Ursuline nuns kept excellent records, of the nuns inflicting violence on slaves. The nuns were committed to protecting those who had violence committed against them, as well as victims of abuse. Somehow, to reiterate, human bondage fell outside of those ideals. But needless to say, the nuns were not violent against their slaves. They encouraged women who were slaves to buy their freedom. As for slaves that tried to escape or cause violence themselves, you know, because being enslaved kind of makes people angry and want their freedom, well, the Ursuline nuns simply sold them off. It's a not-in-my-backyard solution, whereby slaves are sold to new owners who potentially might not have such nonviolent tendencies. But even the act of slavery was not so cut and dry with the Ursuline nuns. They continued to educate their bondspeople and encourage them to get married and have families. No single source I read for this was able to elucidate how exactly this equation was balanced. Yes, the nuns instilled education and literacy to women, be they orphans, French, Spanish, Creole, women of color, slaves, and free women of color, but how does one square the idea that you are all equal and worthy of God's love, but a portion of you are also property? This obviously is something I cannot answer in this podcast and probably in my lifetime. That is not for me to answer. I just do not have that wisdom as of yet. In 1803, following the Louisiana Purchase, New Orleans witnessed an influx of American Catholics as well as Protestants. And Protestantism being America's preferred flavor of Christianity at the time. If the Ursuline nuns were founded to escape the prevailing patriarchal views in Europe, they now saw those familiar and ugly heads rearing in the American Protestants coming into New Orleans, but with a twist. We must keep in mind that the Protestant Reformation occurred in the 16th century, but it wasn't exactly a flash in the pan. The Americans on the East Coast were not only mostly Protestant, but they were decidedly anti-Catholic, save for Boston. While Protestant women certainly leveraged their education and piety to gain more equal footing with their male counterparts, the very core of Protestantism, in its many shades and hues, placed women in subservient roles. Many Americans who moved to New Orleans were uncomfortable, to say the least, with the amount of agency the super-Catholic Ursuline nuns wielded. They were unmarried women who influenced local politics, generated wealth, and had tremendous support, even if it was given begrudgingly at times, from the population of New Orleans. The Ursuline nuns didn't need the okay of white men to operate as they had for 80 years after landing in New Orleans. And even though their operations were seemingly sanctioned by a higher power, that did not prevent them from engaging in some of the worst behavior to mar this country's timeline. Nor does it absolve them of these actions. But hey, those vampires were pretty bad too, right? And that's kind of what this all boils down to. In our desire to look anywhere else but directly in the face of atrocities people have done to one another over the centuries in the name of God and conquest, the idea of vampires is actually a comforting notion. We wrap it up in tourism and cocktails to take the edge off, because the real history can be too much to take. And hey, come to New Orleans and learn about some of the largest indelible stains white people have placed on the map of North America in the name of God and territorial expansion doesn't quite draw in the tourists like an ever-present yet never-proven group of vampires operating from one of the oldest convents in the country. But that's not to say the Ursuline nuns are a force of evil. Ursuline Academy is the oldest school and the oldest school for females in the United States. Not even my old college can admit that, and it was founded as a women's college in 1742. Ursuline Academy was founded in 1727. The Ursulines in New Orleans are very much like any Catholic high school today, but with a much higher literacy rate. Sure, there are still some problematic things in the overall attitude toward, say, the LGBTQ community, but the Ursuline nuns still turn out some of the most literate and critically thinking graduates to this day. And honestly, analytical minds seem to be absent from the larger picture right now. So this one constant of the Ursulines is at least good. So that's pretty much the end of this story. This has been an overview of the Ursuline nuns of New Orleans. And honestly, I just scratched the surface. If you want to take a much deeper dive into the topic, check out Masterless Mistresses by Emily Clark. I started off reading the book with some apprehension, but after a few pages, I simply couldn't put it down. Definitely add it to your reading list if you want to learn more about the early days of New Orleans, or if you just want additional information on how religion and the attitudes of different countries influenced the behavior of the South prior to the Civil War. And now it's time for announcements. As I mentioned earlier at the start of the show, I've been reorganizing and restructuring things, and part of that has involved migrating over to a new platform. This means a few things for the listeners, and none of them are bad. Part of the migration meant moving away from SoundCloud. SoundCloud is great for what it does, but it really didn't allow me to do what I wanted. With this new platform, not all of the podcasts will be funneled into one channel. The Mothball Prophecies will be its own show, and podcasts like The Golden Crescent and the others that are in the works will have their own respective feeds as well. This way, listeners aren't getting shows about small business and whatnot jammed into their paranormal fix. This also gives me wider distribution and makes finding the Mothball Prophecies easier for listeners instead of the I can't find you or I can't listen unless I have a SoundCloud account messages that I've been getting since I first started this show. I'm also going to be doing more casual stuff in between big topics. Maybe a look at weird things that are making the news, possibly a call-in show, or even a roundtable discussion. This means more content for you on a more frequent basis, and it gives me time to do the research I need for the big topics, instead of rushing out episodes with droughts of content in between. This restructuring thing started a little over a month ago, and should be finalized by the time the next episode hits. Speaking of which, on the next episode of the Mothball Prophecies, I've got a story for you. It's a conspiracy of global proportions that took place right here in New Orleans. It's got assassinations. It's got energy weapons. It's got monkeys. What more could you want? So like our Facebook page and keep sending those emails to mothball@crescentcitymedia.com. And until next time, sleep tight.